Hello, everybody. This is your host, Bob Wintermute, welcoming you again to New Books in Military History. Each week, we select a new title and chat with the author about their work. This week, we're continuing our focus on the Second World War, as our guest author, Jörg Muth, chats about his recent book, Command Culture, Officer Education in the U.S. Army and the German Armed Forces, 1901 to 1940, and the consequences for World War II. Muth's book, which has recently been selected for the U.S. Army Chief of Staff's professional reading list, is a provocative analytical comparison of the respective cultures of officership in the U.S. Army and the German Armed Forces in the first half of the 20th century. In setting up his comparison, Muth pulls few punches in his critique of the flaws resident in both institutions. Yet while the American Army does manage to overcome these flaws, Muth notes the Wehrmacht ultimately fell victim to its own hubris and ossified culture inherent in its origins. He continues to offer valuable insights as to how these institutional problems and successes continue to shape the culture of officership in the U.S. Army today. I will especially recommend reading Muth's book in tandem with one of our earlier choices, Michael Matheny's Carrying the War to the Enemy, American Operational Art to 1945. I think that taken together, the two books present an interesting debate on the subject of American military culture in the Second World War. Jörg, good morning.
Good morning.
Everybody, today we're talking with Jörg Muth about his book, Command Culture, Officer Education in the U.S. Army and the German Armed Forces, 1901 to 1940, and the Consequences for World War II. A graduate of the University of Utah and an expert in German military history, Jörg currently lives in Marburg, Germany. Jörg, why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and why you chose the project?
Yeah, I did not have that straightforward academic career that most people have. I come from a very poor family, so after 10 years of school with living on pocket money, I was pretty much fed up with the whole thing and decided to, you know, learn a job, a profession first and get some money and then turn around and go to night school and do my degree because I always wanted to get my PhD in history. So even when I was a kid, you know, I read all the history books, especially military history books, you know, the huge books with the big pictures on battles, on tanks and all that stuff. So I fell in love with military history very, very early. But I just decided to, you know, make money first and then go to the university. And I did not know then what I know now. And that is that Germany is one of the most unfair countries in the world when it comes to social mobility. So it did not turn out that easily as I wished, you know, just learning one profession and then going back to the university was pretty hard. So first, I became an apprentice for a salesman, in a large company that sold, computers and, office supplies and, printers and stuff like that. And it was the pioneer times of the computers. So it was a time when, 10 megabyte hard drive had the size of a shoebox and cost $20,000. Yeah, that was really cool. So I had lots of fun at that time, and I discovered that I had some affinity to computers. I understood them, and I liked them, and they liked me back. At least until the curse of Bill Gates came to Windows, and then it became more difficult, and you know had to become more like a psychiatrist to computers than, you know, really an expert. So I worked in the computer business because it was so much fun in the pioneer days of the computer business. I worked for several years because it was so much fun. Then I traveled the world. I went to the United States, traveled through the United States for several weeks, and did all the battlefield stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Lookout Mountain, Chickamauga Battlefield, Chattanooga Battlefield, going onto the museum carriers, you know, the museum battleships like USS Alabama, Mobile Bay. So that was a great time. And it fueled, of course, my love for military history. So I went to night school and got my degree. In Germany, you need the Abitur. So yes. You need 13 years of school, which is lots of stuff. So while I worked in the computer business, I got my degree, and then I went to the university. And I started out with peace and conflict studies, and then I changed universities, and I did history, sociology, and law, which was all very, very helpful in my later career. Yeah. And in Germany, you cannot study military history in a narrow path like that often is in the United States. You have to do history like everybody else. So you have to do ancient times, medieval times, everything. And if you have to know your stuff, and then you can, kind of specialize in military history. But it's not possible just to do the military history stuff. So in Germany, when you finished your master, which is a magistratium, and not an American master, you are an historian. You're not a graduate student. So when I came to the United States, I was demoted to being a graduate student. So I went to the United States because in Germany I had no, I guess you get it from my foreword from the book, that because I got no opportunities here. Right. Military history is still very difficult in Germany, and especially if your topic is the U.S. Army. Yeah. So if you do military history in Germany, you have to do the Wehrmacht all over. You have to become an expert in Second World War and Wehrmacht. That's inevitable. And there's lots of very, very good research on the armed forces of the Third Reich in Germany right now.
Oh, so very, very socially oriented as well.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Lots of stuff. And it has so far only a fraction of it has made it to the United States. So that is a sad thing that, people who do not read German cannot participate. Yeah. But my love was the U.S. Army. And not the Wehrmacht. So during all that time, when I had to do the Wehrmacht, I studied all the time the U.S. Army. Well,
I was going to say, that kind of ties into the book itself about being a comparative study, rather than an exclusive look at either the American or the German armies. And from what you're telling me, you were led that way from the start of your project.
Absolutely, absolutely. I absolutely wanted to do a book on the U.S. Army. Because as a kid, I met the U.S. soldiers here. My village was a maneuver area for two times a year. So I had hundreds and thousands of U.S. soldiers here. And I always made friends with them. And I always was fascinated with their equipment and all that stuff. So you read that from my afterword, So I wanted to make Dennis Showalter and Edward Kaufman. They suggest I write that afterwards so people know I am not biased against the U.S. Army. Mm. And that was a very good suggestion. It was a very good suggestion because if you criticize an organization, some people take that personally. So, and they said, we know all that stuff is solid. Your research is solid, but you might want to write a few words about, your personal relationship about the U.S. with the U.S. Army and how you come to research all that stuff. So and that's why I wrote that afterward. And it was really, I think it was really very good advice.
Well, it's good advice. It's a very touching afterward. And, I think they're right, too, because for a person to, an uninitiated person in, say, academic military history to read your book, they might come away thinking that you were grinding an axe against the American military tradition, which is absolutely not the case. I want our listeners to understand, this is a very subtly written, but also very astute and really quite ingenious approach towards looking at the issues of officer culture between two different national case studies that are also closely intertwined. The German Heeres and the United States Army from even before the First World War, as you point out as well.
Right.
Sort of the beginning of the book, command culture, what is it?
Well, I define command culture in several ways. One way is the way command is exerted. That's the right word. The way you use command. So if an officer is standing on the front lines and commanding, or if an officer rather understands his position and, being backwards in the staff area and, kind of managing the whole thing, managing 10,000 of soldiers. That is one way I understand command culture. And the other way is certainly that what part of an army is an officer. So is he one part of the team, like the U.S. Army rather understands being an officer, or is he the core energy unit of the whole army, like the Germans understand it, being an officer? So there's several ways I understand command culture. So let me go back for just a moment.
Absolutely.
Because I wanted to completely answer the question how I, you know, came to the idea of writing the book. The initial idea was to write Foreigners, Foes, Friends. And it was a much larger book, and that dealt with the perception U.S. officers had of their German counterparts. So what did they think about the Germans before the war, during the war, and after the war? And there were dramatic changes in their opinion about the Germans. But that was so big that some of my committee members told me, you know, take a part out, you know, take a part of that whole idea, that huge project out, and use that for your PhD.
Right.
And that was very good advice. So I took out the chapter about officer education, and then I blew that up into the PhD and into the book. So I found out there's so much about officer education. There's so many things misunderstood. There's so much stuff not researched. There's, for example, not a single monograph on the Kriegsakademie.
Right.
So there's lots of, you know, white spots in officer education historiography. So that was very, very good advice. So I took that out of my initially much larger project. So that's how command culture came into being.
Well, it's an excellent choice. And again, for our listeners, I mean, it's really so revealing as well about the academic process, you know, where we come into a project, but often our vision is bigger than the capabilities to complete a single monograph. And, you know, the need then to edit ourselves.
Well, especially when it's a PhD, you know.
Oh, yeah, with the PhD dissertation,
yeah.
Absolutely.
That is very important, because often PhDs are just, you know, that is information that is gathered in years of pain, and then you have to send it out for free, basically, you know. You're not getting anything. That was able to publish that book so fast, and that it is not available at ProQuest. That was just plain luck and negotiations.
Well, I could comment on the luck you had with getting your book published, but I won't compared with mine. your book begins with a dual assessment of the state of affairs in both armies at the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And one of the things that interested me from the start was the extent of the German influence on the U.S. Army prior to the First World War. Now, I think this may come as a surprise to many of our listeners who consider that a period of transition from the Western frontier to preparation for modern war. How deep does that influence go in the Army at that time?
Well, that hooked me up too. When I found it out, you know, I've written a book about the army of Frederick the Great, about the desertion in the army of Frederick the Great before my PhD even. And that's why I have that knowledge of the connection between the Prussians and the Americans. And I was already fascinated at that time that the colonials or the guys who wanted independence in the United States, that they had such a good relationship to the Prussians. And there even was a faction of the Americans who wanted Frederick's brother as a king in the United States. Because first, you know, it's a great problem for all revolutionaries what to do with the king. So, but if you have a new king, it's not as problematic. So the French just killed their king. So that was one of their solutions. But a faction of the Americans, they just thought, you know, why not just put in a better king than we have in Great Britain? So there were indeed negotiations between the Americans and the Prussians about, you know, just borrowing a Prussian king. But it never happened. Never took place. But they had these great connections between each other. There was a very, very amiable relationship. So when they requested that officers should be sent to the United States, not yet the United States, Frederick the Great, he was happy to oblige, and he sent officers. So he sent officers who he thought were not first rate. But he was mistaken, because Baron von Steuben, he was an outstanding officer, and he was just exactly what the Americans needed at that time. And his flexible mind helped to shape the U.S. Army at that time.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, yeah, if he had been that rigid, like, you know, people have that mind of Russian officers being, it would not have worked, not at all. But he had that flexible mind that he could, you know, take stuff from the Prussians and take stuff from the Americans and mold it into a unique disciplinary structure. And it was also very interesting for me to know that so many of Frederick's military writings, which were supposed to be top secret, had made their way to the Americans and were even, you know, reprinted all the time. So one of my sources said that he found the famous instructions of Frederick Great for his generals many times with the officers of Washington's army.
Well, Americans understand, of course, the connection of von Steuben to the Continental Army and, you know, the great debt that's owed there. I think where many Americans lose connection, though, is the idea of a continuing German influence through the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we, of course, you know, some of us understand about the role of Germans in the American Civil War, but we don't think about a direct connection between German officership and American officership.
Right, right. So that was the funny thing about American officers going to Europe all the time. They were going all the time, going to Europe and, you know, looking at those weird Europeans who were constantly, in the mind of the Americans, constantly waging war against each other and had some, you know, kind of bloodthirsty mentality, you know, because it seemed every year there was a big war going on in Europe. So there were lots of American officers. I think even before the American Civil War, more than 100 coming to Germany, coming to Europe and studying the armies and studying the military system. And what they studied first was, you know, saddles. It was, you know, belts. It was shoes. It was hats. For one time, for a brief time, the Americans even had introduced the Pickelhaube, the German, you know, helmet with the spike.
Right.
So, and I was amazed that they did not focus on stuff like, you know, officer training, command, and all those things. And it was at first completely missed. And only when Germany had won three wars, when Moltke the Elder had won three wars, then the Americans thought about, you know, maybe we should look at the staff, maybe we should look at the educational system and all that stuff. And that was surprising to me that it took so long for the Americans, even though so many were there and so many looked at from different angles and perspective at the Prussian army, the German army, that it took so long that they, you know, assessed the educational system.
Well, of course, it's the influence of Napoleon and the Second Empire as well on American perceptions of military affairs. And you're right, it would take, you know, successive German victory in the 1860s and 1870s to change that mindset.
Yeah, exactly. So, but when they looked at the German system, they looked only at the structures. And that was one of the great mistakes the Americans made. So I think it was Sheridan who said, you know, it would be a great mistake if we just copied the structure and not copied the spirit, the German spirit. And that was indeed the great problem. And that is one of the, you know, kind of the red line that goes through my book, that the Americans did not really understand the German idea of, you know, making officers and how it was so different.
Right.
The military culture, especially the command culture between the Americans and the Germans, was so different that it was really hard to grasp for Americans. Even at the end of the Second World War, there were only very few American generals who had an idea about, you know, Auftragstaktik, about the officer education in Germany and all that stuff. That was very interesting to me.
Well, at the same time, when you're setting the stage in describing the extent of German influence, you also know that the German general staff itself was not as perfect a model as some have described as well. You know, it had its own flaws as well.
Exactly, exactly. So we have a huge pile of glorifying literature about the German general staff, and it was actually the weakest point of the Germans in the 20th century. It was one of the weakest parts of the whole army. So I would appreciate if the guys who you know, don't like me criticizing the U.S. Army, see that point too. Because I'm criticizing the German army as well. Yeah. They're not looking too good either in my book. So the whole thing changed when Moltke the Elder died. So he was kind of a very special person, like George C. Marshall on the American side.
Right.
And what is not often enough looked at, that is leadership. That is the personal leadership. And in an army that has such a steep hierarchy, single persons can have a great impact on a whole structure. So if you have an amazing leader on the top of the structure, you know, that his capability trickles down. If you have an incapable person on the top of the pyramid, things look really gloomy because a staff in itself, a general staff in itself, is not a helpful organization.
Well, these are hierarchies which are highly intuitive as well, which respond to the impulses of their leaders.
Exactly, yeah. So two of the greatest chief of staff, like George C. Marshall and Moltke the Elder, shared a trait, interestingly to me, and it was common sense. So you don't find that often when generals are assessed, you know, that they have all kinds of perceptional ability, you know, ability to command, but common that they are assessed by common sense. That is rare. And I think that tells a lot.
Yeah.
That tells a lot.
Were there any particular areas where the American system outclassed the Germans early on?
Well, the Americans were much farther ahead than the Germans in strategy. So when you look at the discussions that the Germans have about the war, that is all fuzzy. You know, it's not really a clear cut goal on how to wage the war. So all the resources, many resources are wasted. Many resources the Germans would need are wasted. There's sometimes really on the spot decisions, you know, partly fueled by Hitler, partly fueled by generals who are of his opinion. So there's it can be no, people say often, you know, it's one of the great excuses of the German generals that they were against Hitler and Hitler called all the shots. That's absolutely not correct. There were so many generals who agreed with Hitler's military goals. And so many of them were wrong and many of them were not high class generals. So the general staff of the Germans in the Second World War was really a bad example for it. All the decisions that were made, attack on France, attack on the Soviet Union, they were not sound strategic a formula. It was not a sound strategic formula.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to that in a moment as well. I mean, when we speak directly about the Second World War, because there are a couple of points you raise with reference to a culture of disobedience that seems to be forsaken during the interwar years.
That's correct.
But before we get to there, you know, talking about the interwar years, there's, of course, this misperception that exists, I think, of the German army on many levels in American writing and American thought as being very, you know, rigid, very hidebound, very obsessed with discipline and order that aren't exactly accurate.
Exactly.
But I want to ask you, how do these perspectives influence the American view of the Germans during the interwar years?
It does not really show up.
No.
They don't really have a perception about that. So when there's disagreement and inside the US Army, you know, in Torch, during Torch, you have lots of disagreement because, you know, they're U.S. Army is really trying to do war. They don't really have experience with large-scale landing operations and all that stuff. Many of them have never been in combat. So you have lots of frictions and stuff during Torch, the landing in North Africa. And it never shows up when there's disagreement. Terry de la Mesa Allen, the commander of the 1st Infantry Division, you know, he was disagreeing all the time. And at the end, he was relieved from his command for not really good causes. Right. So there never shows up the idea, you know, you should stand up for your views and he might be right or he might not be right. But at the end, it is always a disadvantage when you disagree in the U.S. Army. So you don't really, they're not really fostering mavericks. And for war, you really need mavericks. Right. Because if you don't have them, that then you're waging war like a formula. So all that doctrine stuff that the U.S. Army puts out is not helping during their waging of war. The most important thing for an officer is a flexible mind. And it is not that he follows some formula or follows some doctrine.
Mm-hmm. So the Americans weren't driven or they weren't affected by misperceptions of the Germans?
Yeah, I have all these citations when they talk about the German general staff and that they don't really know what's going on there.
Yeah. What about the Germans? I mean, are they driven by misperceptions of their American foes?
Oh, yeah, a lot. So one of the great failures of the German officer corps is arrogance. So they really think nobody's up their standards. You know, not many were up to their standards, but there were lots of good officers in the U.S. Army. So the U.S. Army just did not produce a system that made good officers. That's another thing that is often misunderstood about my book. You know, that people think that I mean that the American officer corps, or the American officers as a whole, were incapable. That is absolutely not the case. The Americans just had a bad system of making officers. So, but there were lots of outstanding officers, and they were the Germans were totally underestimating them. So, people like Patton, they at the end of the war they really scared the Germans. So he was one of the most feared enemies of the Germans. But it took a long time until they realized that there are commanders that are as capable as the Germans, and until then, harm was already done. When you have then you constantly underestimate your enemy. So sooner or later, you have to pay for it.
Sure. Well, let's talk about that officer selection process.
Yeah.
Which is so flawed because it's a big part of the book, obviously.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's start with the U.S. system, and you do take the West Point system test.
That is correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's describe for our readers what some of the major flaws are.
Yeah, let me first tell you how I arrived at all that stuff. How I arrived at my methodology, how I approached the book. Mm-hmm. Because first I took stock, and I was kind of surprised that mostly they're only structural histories. They tell how many years you have to be at the military academy, what is the number of certain courses that are taught, what kind of degree do you have, to what kind of unit will you go when you have finished all these things? How is your access to the military academy? Mm-hmm. So, and I was surprised that there was so little research and primary sources on how those officers or how the cadets really felt about the institution that they passed through.
Right. Well, you see it only in memoir form, really.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it's often clouded by, the mellowing of age, when in general it's 82 years old, writes memoirs about West Point. He's not really critical.
No.
So that was my task, to go down and find diaries and letters of people who were generals and once were cadets and were 18, 19, 20 years old. And what was their feeling about, when they went to West Point, when they went through the command and general staff school, how did they like it? So in all these other structural histories, they cannot do that. They're extremely helpful, of course, for me. I need to know when was a certain institution, when was it founded? Why did the names change? How many years were officers there? So that was extremely helpful, but I wanted to advance one more step. I wanted to know about the didactics and the pedagogy of the institution. Okay. So, and it was very revealing to me when I read all these, letters and diaries that people, that the office were really not appreciative of the institution. They thought they could do many, many more things, and they were, putting the brakes on them. They felt when they went to West Point and when they went to the Command and General Staff School as if they had to stop and have to slow down all the time because the structure of the school was so tedious. So when you read the diaries, what often comes up when they describe the daily life at West Point, it is tedious. It is very tedious. And it's not the same when you look at the letters that German Kadetten write about their life at the Kadettenschule in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that was lively, you know, it was action, it was fun. And when you have generals like Joe Lawton Collins, who writes in his memoirs, you know, I was one of the very few persons who enjoyed his life at West Point, then you, that really has to make you think. Because the people who went initially to West Point, they were extremely enthusiastic. They were totally motivated. And so somebody wrote, and I quoted that in my book, that really what they did, they wasted an enormous amount of youthful enthusiasm at these institutions, because, you know, they had to do all these tedious little things, looking at the uniform in an amount that made no sense anymore. When you get a demerit because you put waste into the waste basket, you really have to think about, you know, if that helps making an officer.
Well, that's part of the hazing problems too.
Exactly. That is part of the hazing problem. And that is one of the things that I also found extremely surprising. You know, I had read all kinds of stuff about West Point, but I never thought it would be really a system that was in place for hundreds of years. So that really nobody made the decision, a general, and said, you know, hazing did not help me at all. It did not make me a tough guy. It did not make me a tough son of a bitch. And then when I was under fire, the hazing did not help me at all. You know, the leadership of my superior officer helped me. The example of my sergeant major helped me, you know, not running away under fire. But it was not the hazing at West Point. So maybe we should abolish that hazing completely. But it's such an ingrained part of the U.S. Army officer education that it's very, very hard to get rid of. And to me, it was completely surprising. In Germany, you had the same problem. You know, you had the same problem before the end of the 19th century, but then Auftragstaktik was developed. Right. And an officer needed, you know, a flexibility of mind. He needed to move freely, and he needed to have the confidence, self-confidence to do that. And if you have a young guy who's 16 years old and you push him down all the time and you're no good, you have no idea what you're doing, you know, you're not worth going to the army and all that stuff, then he will not dare making daring decisions in war. So that is the one of these great differences. And the Kadettenschule in Germany, they tried to really pull up people. They tried to raise them in being something bigger, something greater. And you cannot do that when you are treated, you know, like a servant or like somebody who is kind of worthless.
I wonder if in the American case at West Point and hazing, if it's perhaps a reflection of imposing class strictures or class yeah. hierarchies on a people who generally have rejected class up yeah. to that point.
Exactly. That is one explanation I found for that ongoing hazing, but it would only be an explanation for the first decades or so, you know, because after that there should have been, the Americans were at war, and they should have learned, there should have been an assessment what helps an officer and what does not help an officer. And if you read the pieces on leadership that really great American generals wrote, like, you know, like Ridgway and like Patton, and there's nowhere to be found that hazing in any way helps you be a great leader. It's nowhere to be found. So
you could even go back conversely to the American Civil War and look at who the outstanding leaders are in the Union Army, and or even in the Confederate Army, and ask the same question. You'll find it didn't help them either.
Exactly, and that's why one of the Union generals already wrote that book, and he surmised that West Point generals, officers who had West Point education, were in no way superior to officers who had no West Point education. And that is one of the things, you know, that surprised me when I looked at the historiography, because people passed through schools, through the American schools, and because the U.S. Army undoubtedly won the war, that people made the connection that because they passed through the schools and they won the war, they were taught, you know, enormously useful stuff. And that to me was just an assumption. And assumptions need, for an historian, you need to prove, you need to check on the facts, you need to check on all that stuff. It was just the same when I wrote my first book about the desertion in the army of Frederick the Great, when you read everywhere that the Prussian soldiers were beaten
every day, you know, every day and every day. And it was just life. And that's why the soldiers deserted. So if you believe all that stuff and never check on the facts, then historiography repeats itself all the time. If you want to go a step ahead, you change your methodology. So that's why I went to the archive and checked on the sources. What did the Prussian soldiers think about their daily life? Proved to be totally different. And it's the same with the U.S. Army. When you look at the sources, what people think about West Point, and especially what people thought when they went through the Commander General Sess School, then it did no longer fit that bill, you know, that they learned this amazing, important stuff to win the Second World War.
Well, was there anything positive to come out of West Point? I mean, you know, in terms of the curriculum or the experience?
Well, most of the guys who went through West Point, they became total fitness buffs. You know, they were extremely fit. The American generals, you know, like Eisenhower and Bradley and Patton, they were extremely fit guys.
Yeah.
And they kept that up all their life. So when they went to war, and, you know, war is really an exhausting business, especially when you are in North Africa and stuff. And those guys, they did not just hang around. Most of them did not just hang around. So Eisenhower was driving to the front lines. He was looking around, you know, and Patton, first, he was always on the front lines. So people with lesser fitness, they would never have made it. So that is why Marshall washed out so many colonels and so many generals, because they just could not keep up. So that was one, for me, one of the positive things that came out of West Point, but it's really not much. You know, One guy who was a former West Point officer, he wrote in his thesis about the curriculum changes that it was so helpful that they could bond, you know, at West Point. But of course, it was helpful that they could bond at West Point. But if you think also about the hazing, then, you know, that might change that idea that the bonding was so important. Mm-hmm. And you can also bond at different places. Yeah. For the German officers, for example, it was not really important if they went through Kadettenschule together. It was way more important at which regiment they served. So the bonding for German officers took place in the regiment and not during the schools.
Well, another thing I would think of, too, with the problem with the schools is if you're instilling a sense of class hierarchy or privilege amongst officers, it kind of becomes an obstacle when you create a citizen army. And you're serving not only over, but with non-West Pointers who
exactly.
You know, expect, you know, equal treatment.
Exactly. And that is exactly one of the problems that was pointed out when people wrote about the West Point officers or professional or regular officers in the First World War or in the Second World War, that they just had people issues. They were just lacking in social skills dealing with citizen soldiers. And that happened all the time. And I'm so surprised that so few people who write about the performance of the U.S. Army in the Second World War did not read Stauffer's, you know, huge opus magnum, The American Soldier, where the sociologists really researched the opinions and the behavior of the U.S. soldiers and their connection, their interactions with the officers, because that is totally revealing. And they did not have a good opinion of their officers.
Right.
So, and it's totally different in the German army. German veterans, you know, who are now 70 years old, 80 years old, they still remember the officers. They remember the names. They remember the special traits of the officers, because the officers were all around. The officers, you know, showed good leadership. Whereas at the American army at large, oftentimes, they did not even know their own battalion commander because he was not around. So, and that's all stuff that has to be taken into account. There's some kind of lionizing literature about, you know, the performance of the U.S. Army in the Second World War. And those things should not be forgotten when you write about the supposedly great performance of the officers or the officer corps. Right. What a reviewer of my book said is that there's some sort of triumphalist. Is that the right word?
Triumphalist spirit in American literature. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Greatest
exactly.
Generation hagiography.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that is indeed the case, because one reason is because
the American officers of innards of the Second World War. They were supposedly really good, and they were supposedly, you know, great guys. But if you look deeper, that is not the case.
Which is very true. And also, if you look at outstanding junior or mid-grade field officers, many of them were actually products of ROT systems as much as they were of West Point.
Exactly.
Let's move on to the issues. You refer, of course, to the Commander General Staff College. Let's talk about the issues with this postgraduate stage of officer education in the 1930s. Now, you know, to the CGSC, the Commander General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth, was much more didactic and accordingly flawed than the German Kriegsakademies.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
The first problem was with entering all these institutions. So for the Americans, American officers were often puzzled on how to get into the Command and General Staff School. It was already recognized at that time that it was a ticket-punching post. You know, you had to go there to become a general, become promoted. So people wanted to go there, but it was not transparent how to go there. So how to go to the German Kriegsakademie, you could find that in every civilian and in every military library. So, you know, how to access them, you know, how to go there, what examinations you needed to know, what you need to know in the examinations, what they would ask you, basically, all that stuff. And in the United States, there was still a problem. Even George C. Marshall, you know, who knew the American Army up and down, in and out, he confessed in one of his letters, you know, it becomes more and more problematic to go to the Command General Staff School. So that was the first thing, the access to the institution. In Germany, that was all, you know, spelled out to everybody, how to go to the Kriegsakademie. You just had to work hard. You had to pass the Wehrkreisprüfung, the defense district examination, and the basics that you needed to know, that were also common knowledge among the officer corps. Because those who passed through the Kriegsakademie, so they taught their fellow officers on how to, you know, pass the examinations. So when you finally went to, when an officer made it in the United States to the Command General Staff School, they did not know what awaited them. If they had no good buddy like Patton, who always wrote to his younger, you know, fellow officers on how to pass through Leavenworth, or Ike, he gave his friends advice on how to pass through Leavenworth. There was no, you know, nothing was written down from the U.S. Army on how to go there, what to know when you went there. So many of them were totally surprised on what was expected of them. So many had to newly learn how to learn, which of course was a great advantage, because many American officers had not touched the book in years, you know. Mm-hmm. Only those who I already named who were exceptions, those who taught themselves all the time, those who were voracious readers, they were up to the whole thing. And then there's always the same names that show up, and that already shows you how few there were in the U.S. Army who were up to outstanding standards, you know, like Patton, like Ridgway, like Collins, like Terry Allen, and like Eisenhower. So they were reading all the time. So still, the whole system of the Command General Staff School came to a surprise to the American officers, because they were all officers of many, many years of service. So, you know, they were not dumbasses. There were really many of them knew their stuff in and out. And when they were suddenly examined on drill regulations, this is the stuff a first lieutenant has to know, they become very, you know, annoyed. They become disappointed in all these things. Something like that would never happen at the Kriegsakademie, where you only do, you know, high-level war games and stuff like that. So there is a totally discrepancy in the level of education and stuff that is asked of an officer. So at the Kriegsakademie, if you wanted to go there, you had to first pass the defense district examination. And every officer had to go there, because the German army wanted to have a great selection. They wanted to get all the good officers they were able to get.
Right.
So everybody had to attend the defense district examination, everybody who was deemed fit by his regimental commander. So he would quiz you first, you know. They would not send an officer to the examination if he was not fit to go there, because it would be a disgrace to the regiment if you got a bad grade.
So, and in general, it took 1.5 years to make yourself ready for the defense district examination. And it took so long, even with the help of your fellow officers who already passed through. So the whole examination took 5 years to seven, 5 days to 7 days. So I named that all in my book, you know, all the tactical questions that they had. They were not all, only asked about, you know, basic knowledge and analysis. They were also asked about their opinion. And that already shows another different approach, another different culture in the German army, that they very much valued the opinion of their junior, the most junior officers. And it was totally different in the U.S. Army, where, you know, they normally majors and colonels or even generals thought that a lieutenant or a captain is good for nothing. No, it's a know-nothing. And that's how they usually were treated in the U.S. Army, unless there were lots of casualties and you needed just, you know, you absolutely had to fill the slots.
Well, it's also the primacy of the so-called school solution, too. I mean, you know, validating exactly the instructor's brilliance by parroting their own responses.
Exactly. And that is one of the surprising things for me, that it's still defended today. It is still defended in historiography and in the officer corps today, you know, that the school solution is a great idea. It is an awful idea. And it really harnesses the mind of an officer. You have experienced officers, and many of them are so motivated to do, you know, war games. That is one of the great, at least for German officers, is one of the most, the best thing to do in their pastime, except for going to war, you know, doing a war game. Mm-hmm. So they were extremely motivated. And if you harness that motivation or even block that motivation by telling them after the whole war game is done, you know, your idea is totally rubbish. I am the instructor. My idea is the only thing how you can approach the whole, you know, operation. And then they are disappointed. They are dissatisfied. And the same happened to, and that happened in the United States at the Command General Staff School. Officers were all the time dissatisfied about the performance of the instructors, about what they were taught and how they were taught. So you have to take a step away, a step above the structural historiography, and you cannot only count the number of lessons they got in intelligence, the number of lessons they got in military history. You have to check on how they were taught.
How they're applying that information as well.
Exactly. Everybody of us knows at the university or at school of a teacher who was absolutely brilliant and who could make the most boring topic interesting, and others who could ruin the most interesting topic. So it is very interesting, very important on how people were taught. I thought that so interesting in that interview you did with Mahaney about the book Operational American Operational Art, and he was so amazed all the time about the level of intelligence how much was devoted to intelligence. Right. So, and it is correct that the number of lessons in intelligence was pretty high, but the teaching in intelligence, what the people really took with them, that was really an extremely low level. And it was already at that time criticized by the great experts in intelligence in the U.S. Army. And during the war, and people were great generals were criticizing that all the time. They said, you know, our intelligence training was really bad, and he got it at the Command and General Staff School. Walter Beadle Smith, for example, you know, he was cursing the intelligence training all the time, because when the U.S. Army encountered the Germans, they didn't know much,
right?
And they did not properly analyze and utilize the information they already had.
Well, part of that too is a learning curve, I'm certain as well. But you're right that it's remarkable they didn't know much, because there was an exchange program in place between the two institutions as well.
Yeah. That is one major point, that American officers were exchanged to the Germans, and German officers were exchanged to the Americans, even though the German officers were not really keen to go to the United States because they thought there's not much to learn. And those who were there, they confirmed these things, right, except for Adolf von Schell, who was at the infantry school.
Yes, well, I was going to bring up both George Marshall and von Schell as well, who are really in this chapter on the American Command General Staff School. I mean, these are the two bright lights in the system, and it's interesting as well, the relationship that they had with each other and balanced against that, against the respect that the two men share for their opposing institutions. I mean, it's very clear in Marshall's tenure as chief of staff, you know, he had a good finger on the pulse of what the German Army's core ideals were and its mission was.
That's
far
right.
More so than perhaps any other general. And Schell, from what you report, Schell, who, to me, I did not know who he was prior to your book, this person who's an important liaison between the American and the German militaries.
Exactly. So let me comment first on what you said. You said it was a learning curve for the Americans, you know, when they encountered Germans. That is true only to a certain degree, because there was no army, no possible future opponent of which the U.S. Army had so much information than it was about the Germans. They had such a load of information about the German army because of that liaisons, because of the military attaches, because of that outstanding connection that existed between the German army and the U.S. army, that really, if they had analyzed that properly, all these failures, the failures at the beginning would not have happened.
I mean, it's safe to say that the Americans knew more about the German army in 1939 than they knew about the British army.
Absolutely.
I mean, due to those liaisons.
Yeah, that is absolutely safe to say. And I went through all the military attaché reports at the National Archives, and I can tell you they were amazingly accurate. Amazingly accurate. So, and if they just, you know, had analyzed that properly, disseminated that properly, there would not have been so many surprises. And that points out how crappy the intelligence training really was.
Well, I mean, part of it, too, is who's responsible, ultimately, in the institution for disseminating that. And again, it falls to the G2, the intelligence branch.
Right.
Which, if it's flawed from the start, they won't know how to proceed with their work. And speculation, perhaps. Returning to Marshall, describe his role in the postgraduate system.
Yeah. So you can see as a whole that the U.S. Army were not really doing good, you know, in war preparation and in teaching and all that stuff. But there were people who made up for it. And the George C. Marshall was one of them. Not only did he know the whole army, you know, in and out, you know, he knew the whole system. He knew so many people, and he knew what he wanted. He knew what kind of leaders and what kind of wartime structure and all this stuff he needed. So he had already envisioned a war army, and he worked to that goal, towards that goal. And he was not, like so many other high-ranking American officers, he was not too, you know, American culture standard that he would not take advice from the Germans, for example. So he really Germanized the teaching at the infantry school to the standards of the Kriegsakademie. So, for example, the Führerausfall, something that is not known in the leader fatality, that is not known during the normal teaching at the Command General Staff School. So at the Kriegsakademie, the first day, they would explain to the students, you know, a really hugely complicated war situation. So, and the students had to prepare in their assigned positions. So you are G1, you are G2, you are the commander of the 1st Division, you are commander of the 2nd Division. So you will prepare, and tomorrow we will fight that war game. So the students, they would, you know, prepare the whole night for that single war game. And then they would, in the morning, they would sit there, you know, totally anxious. And now we fight this big war game. I'm prepared to be the commander of the 1st Infantry Division. So, and then the instructor would stand up and say, you are dead, you are dead, you are dead. So, and now the position is reversed. You are no longer G3, you are commander of the 1st Division, all that stuff. So they were completely shuffled. The guys were completely shuffled. So all that stuff that they had prepared was, of course, connected to the new job, but the more thorough they had prepared, the better they would fare, you know, but it was still a total surprise. You had already the whole list of orders you had prepared for commanding the 1st Infantry Division, and now you were suddenly G4. So, and that stuff that, that Marshall introduced, it was so important for officers to become flexible, to think on their feet. That is one of the most important traits for an officer. You can see that, you know, in all military campaigns throughout history. So it's really that officers should be taught flexibility and not doctrine.
You know, in response to the stereotypical account of the Prussian officer corps, you note that the institution actually has a long culture of disobedience.
That's correct.
How does that affect the perceived professionalism of the institution?
No, it of course, it is part of the whole teaching. It is part of the whole teaching, and that is one thing that changed during the Second World War, when officers were taught all their time, you know, that if they thought professionally, a certain order was incorrect, and they stood at the front lines and saw it was, you know, it would harm the whole war effort, and it would cost casualties, that they really could disobey that order, because absolutely the guys and the staff, you know, they did not know what they were doing. So they were really flabbergasted when orders came from the Army High Command or the Wehrmacht High Command, that they had to, you know, remain in place or shuffle to a certain position, all that stuff, because it went so much against the grain of the teachings in all the military schools.
Well, is it a case of it going, entirely going against the grain, or by that point has the professionalism of the institution been so undermined by political indoctrination and political generals, too? I mean, the influence of
exactly. That is the point. Yeah, it is not the political indoctrination of the schools, because it was hardly existent. You know, I really looked into that, because at a certain time, there was an order that there had to be some National Socialist studies at the Kriegsakademie, but I really never found a curriculum, or I never found anybody who said, you know, we had the guy of the Gauleiter here, and he was telling the officers stuff like that. I never found that. There was just a paper order, but it never really affected the curriculum at the Kriegsakademie. Not as far as I could find out, because there's not really much on the Kriegsakademie.
But yet, then you have politicized officers.
Yeah, exactly, and that was really the problem for the German army. And my summary and my conclusion, I already made the point that generals are differently selected than normal officers, other officers. Right. It's the same in the United States. It's the same in Germany. In Germany, they are no longer selected for their performance. You can safely say that the most officers who were, promoted until colonel, maybe, or until major general in the German army, they were really promoted because they were really good.
Right.
And that made for the excellence and tactics and fighting in the German army. But when they went higher, Generalleutnant, Lieutenant General, or full general, they really were more selected for being streamlined. And that affected the whole German army. So it was not really Hitler cut out the whole Auftragstaktik idea of the operations of the Eastern Front. It was Franz Halder, the chief of staff of the army. And he really started to stop the guys in their tracks, especially the fast troop commanders.
And yet American students of military history of the Eastern Front will point towards figures like von Manstein,
exactly,
or Holtz, or, you know, others, and say, well, these are masters of operational art. How do they not have a greater influence on the outcome of the war? Or, you know, what ties their hands? Initiated students will say, well, it's Hitler. You know, it's clearly OKH or OKW. When it's the politicized generals who were just as culpable.
Exactly. And it was not only about politics. It was really about ego. So the German generals were very jealous against each other. Okay. They weren't buddies like the U.S. Generals. That was one of the great points Martin Blumensohn made. You know, he wrote really very, he was very critical about the U.S. Army officers. So, and I really absolutely agree, because I read all the papers and all that stuff, and I really know that the professionalism in the U.S. Army officer corps was not really high. So, and he was right to criticize all that stuff. I quoted him in my introduction. But he also said, you know, those were great guys to go for a beer. they were great, great guys to go with for a beer, and the German journals were totally different. So they were not buddies like the American generals. They were really extremely jealous for the glory, for the great like Guderian. You know, he was universally hated by the OKW because of his great advances
well,
in France and
all that
stuff.
You point that out too in the case of with Von Schell, that he and Von Schell did not exactly get along well.
Exactly. They had both great ideas, you know. They should have pulled the same rope, as we say in Germany. But instead, they were so jealous that each of them was able to, you know, pour sand into the whole system because they each had different ideas about the motorization. And instead of, you know, getting together, brainstorming and finding a cool way to even make it better, everyone cooked his own meal. So that was really, and that is not a singular event in the German officer corps.
So is that a flaw or a feature then of the independent initiative focus of the Kriegsakademie?
No. That is just arrogance. That is the arrogance of the American officer corps. You know, they were so good. Yeah, sorry, the German officer corps. They were so good. You know, I'm so good. My ideas are so great about motorization. The other guy has no idea about it, and I don't need to listen. I'm a lieutenant general now. So that is one of the problems we have here. Absolutely. And you are right about the generals, the senior generals, who are sometimes, because of their political views, obstructed the whole system, or because they were also jealous because of the younger guys, because they did not listen. Because it was normal that the commander of the fast troops was not really interested about what the OKW 1,000 kilometers in the west was saying about his operations.
Yeah.
And they should not have been interested. Absolutely not. Because it was the prerogative of a fast troop commander to go where he wanted. So you have that friction between the older staff officers and the younger fast troop commanders, and they were harnessed all the time.
Right. Well, some have argued too that's a reflection too of a generational gap of knowledge, in which older officers like the von Kleist and such, who didn't really understand fast warfare the way a Guderian or a Rommel would. And at the same time, the Rommels and the Guderians, who were so insistent that their system was right, refused to countenance any restraint.
It is not only because of the age difference. It is also because of the break in the selection mechanism. And that happened after the First World War. Usually, those who were elevated to high rank, who had, distinguished frontline command. And they had some, you know, smart staff officer who was younger. But the guys who were overall command, those were the guys who had, you know, really long-time frontline command. And that absolutely changed when the Germans' army got cut down through the Versailles Treaty. And suddenly the whole system was, you know, reversed. At that time, already many officers, German officers from different classes had come to the officer corps. Normally, there were the Offiziersfähige Geschichten, the officers capable classes in Germany, where officers were from recruited. That is the sons of officers, of course. That is lawyers. That is doctors. That is higher officials. And that had already changed. The army had changed in a way that officers were promoted because they were good. And that changed after the Versailles Treaty, when von Seeckt, you know, he made new rules on who was selected. You had only 4,000 officers to be selected from a quarter of a million. So, you know, you really, the whole thing was changed. Now there were more from officer capable classes. There were more from nobility. Suddenly, the percentage of officers from nobility was way higher suddenly, and more staff officers. So those who had commanded in the front lines, they were washed out. So, and it is to me that the different selection system, after the First World War, it was really to be blamed for, you know, that kind of stubbornness and that kind of, you know, wanting to help Hitler and all these things. When they had a disagreement, Franz Halder, the army chief of staff, and Hitler, and Halder said to Hitler, you know, that is so hard for your new decision will be so hard for our soldiers, the frontline will cause casualties, and you don't know how that is. And then Hitler exploded. Because Hitler had been at the front lines and Halder had not. So we have a Generaloberst here. We have So a guy who is already one rank above a full general who had never commanded troops in battle. So, and these guys had never before risen to higher rank. That happened only after these new selection rules were made by Hans von Sick after the Versailles Treaty. It was one reason why the Germans lost the war.
You close the book, or come close to closing it, with the following statement. The U.S. Army of those days did not have good officers because of West Point, but in spite of it. Rather than ask you to elaborate on that, you know, that kind of raises the primary question for the entire book, which is if American command control was so problematic compared to that of the German armed forces, how did the American Army manage not only to confront its enemy in the ETO, survive, but ultimately succeed?
That's an important question that needs to be answered, that's for sure. So first, all these advantages that I point out for the selection and the education of German officers has only an impact on the tactical level. Well, and that is one of the reasons why German units were, you know, pulled together of fragments, like, you know, ensigns from a naval school and guys from the Hitler Youth, and you have a battalion but just smashed together from all these different people, and it is led by a captain, a Hauptmann, who is 26 years old and still fight like the devils. You know, that is why the German army excelled on the tactical level. And they were absolutely not capable to advance in a superior manner above that tactical level. Sometimes in operations, when you see in France, you know, when the commanders of the fast troops just take the reins in their own hand and decide what they want, then it works. But on a large scale level, on a strategic level, all these excellent stuff does not help. Because then you need strategically minded, strategically thinking officers, and that the Germans were not ever taught that, and the Americans were taught that, and that is one of the differences. What I wanted to point out is that the American schools were not, you know, completely incapable. They just did not do well enough. So it is so often pointed out how amazing it is that they taught uniformity to an officer corps, you know, that the good things and stuff. You are not supposed to teach just uniformity and how to write a five-paragraph order. You are supposed to teach absolute excellence to officers, because officers decide about the life and death of 10,000 of soldiers. So you can only afford to teach absolute excellence at these schools. So that is one of the main points why the Germans were not more successful. They were extremely successful on tactical level. All the after action reports of the US Army, they proved that no matter where there were small units, you know, battalion against battalion, division against division, the Germans, they fought extremely well. But when it came to the overall picture, it just did not work out, because they did not have that strategic training.
Well, it's also, it's been arguments raised as well about the absence of appreciation for logistics or for in-depth supply planning and such as well. What were your thoughts on that were?
I give that a yes and no, because if the Germans had that ample supply that the Americans had, they would have been way better in logistics.
Oh, sure.
Because you just have a limited number of stuff. It is evident that, you know, they have to make things work out. You have to improvise and stuff like that. And if you have an enormous amount and piles of food supplies, of ammunition and all that stuff, you don't need to be an expert in logistics. So one part of that supposedly logistical excellence of the U.S. Army is just due to the fact that they had an ample supply of all these things. When something did not work out, like opening an harbor in the European theater of operations, immediately there was a shortage of fuel. There was a shortage of grenades for the 105. And stuff like that. So when the Americans were not absolutely on their toes regarding logistics, things slackened also.
Well, I mean, there's certainly the problem, I would guess, of, you know, the embarrassment of riches and, you know, the profligacy that goes with that.
But embarrassment of riches.
Yeah. But yeah. At the same time, you know, the Americans do manage much better in terms of, you know, managing an industrial wartime economy, which is a strategic dimension of warfighting that is absent from a German perspective, no matter what Albert Speer is able to accomplish.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right, yeah.
So how's the experience, and this gets to your afterward, how does the experience of American-German command cultures in World War II linger today? What's the legacy of your work?
Yeah, I was surprised to find, you know, so many traits that were not taught properly in the schools in 1901 to 1940, still present in the U.S. Army of the day. And one of these traits, which is really hampering the U.S. Army effort, is that there is still no mechanism in place that seeks out and fosters mavericks. You know, the U.S. Army is still an army that looks for and awards conformity. So people are not awarded, are not promoted, and not especially promoted because they have offer unusual solutions. They offer great leadership. There are still officers passed over in the U.S. Army who have an excellent combat record, but, you know, they speak out too frankly. They don't know the right people. Stuff like that. They write the wrong books that is, you know, not fitting the mainstream. That was one of the things that I really thought that they should have learned that. You learn it already in corporate business, that when a company goes down and, you know, there's problems with the whole structure, with the sales and so, the first thing you do is you hire mavericks, guys who think out of the box. And the U.S. Army still has not managed to think about it. It is still a career break in the U.S. Army when you disagree openly with the superior. And that is something that was always, until the Second World War, it was always encouraged in Germany, and it was always fostered. So that when there was a huge war game, after a huge war game, the maneuver critique, the first guy who was asked was the youngest lieutenant, you know, to give his critique. So he would not be, you know, cowed by what the general said. So it was always encouraged to speak out, to have a different opinion. And that's something that badly needs to be, that spirit needs to be fostered in U.S. Army education. That was one of the reasons. And the other thing is that Auftragstaktik, one of the most successful command philosophies, is not has not found a home in one of the most democratic armies in the world. It was also very, very surprising to me. You know, you should think that with the fast-moving U.S. Army and the small units they fight today, you need more and more officers who should be allowed to decide on for themselves what they do. And not aspect brigade aspect division aspect corps, and then you even have sometimes to aspect, you know, the land component commander for if you are allowed to attack or not.
I wonder too if, you know, some might not disagree with that and argue that, well, there is a sense of Auftragstaktik in the American Army. We just don't see it, or we don't hear of it because of the nature of the conflict now.
Well, first, it is not taught. So I have not found an officer today who said, you know, I was taught Auftragstaktik.
Yeah.
And you don't find it in operations.
Right.
So one of the glaring examples that I gave was that of the Thunder Run, where a brigade commander who had, I don't know, at that time, 25 years of service under his belt, and that he was on the spot. He had the decision to make. It was very important. And he could not do it because he had to ask back his division commander. And he, in turn, had to ask his corps commander. And all those guys were not on the front lines.
Well, Jörg, I mean, it's a great book. I enjoyed it greatly. And I encourage all our listeners to pick up a copy. Great discussion. We could go on for another hour, certainly, I think. And still just scratch the surface.
Yeah, I appreciate your patience.
No, not at all. Not at all. Listen, you know, we near our close. It's customary that we ask one last question, which is, what is your next project going to be?
Well, I found that there is no
monograph about the social and cultural background of the U.S. Army elite of the Second World War. It is just not in existence. There's three about the German officer corps, and that seems to me a real, real white spot in historiography. And because I have done that enormous amount of research about the U.S. Army officer corps, that would be something that I would like to start if I ever get the funding. So that is one of my problems. I am not in permanent. I don't have a permanent job, so I can do a sales pitch for me here right now. So that is one of the things that I want to do. I would like to write the social and cultural history of the U.S. Army elite, and I would not just gather the data and do all the percentage stuff, but the officers of that time and the historians who wrote later, they already found out that sometimes officers did not know why they were, or most often they did not know why they were promoted for a certain position. So you need to use the most modern methods of sociology to find out who knew who at the in the U.S. Army. And I will use the new software of social network analysis to write that that book. And I have an enormous amount of research from the archives already because of my thesis. You have seen that in the bibliography. So I'm at a good start. I just need I just need a university or a foundation who dares hiring a maverick for writing this stuff.
Well, that's our pitch then. Calling all mavericks who are listening, calling all institutions who are listening who need a maverick. We got one right here.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, I wish you the best luck, York. We'll be talking about it and other things going forward. Thanks again for joining us today.
Bob, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to our interview with York Muth, who's been talking about his recent book, Command Culture, Officer Education in the U.S. Army and the German Armed Forces, 1901 to 1940. This is your host, Bob Wintermute, signing off. Thank you again for listening to New Books in Military History.